Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM HD in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, we're going to talk about today a local issue of national significance, a local issue that I have to admit I wasn't that familiar with. And in the 10 years that I've lived here, I'd never really heard of a case out of Hawkins County, Tennessee. Hawkins County being right next to Kingsport, Tennessee. Kingsport being just to the north of Johnson City, Tennessee. Johnson City being just to the east of Knoxville. Okay, now do you know what we're talking about? We're talking about the eastern tip of Tennessee, a part of the country that many of you may not be very familiar with. But a very significant case and very well known to those who have lived here more than the mere decade or so that I've spent in this part of the country. One of those people is with me right now. In fact, I've got a local girl, someone you've actually heard from before if you're a listener to this show. Can you just say hello, mystery guest, and we'll see if people recognize you.
Hello.
It's Michelle. Of course, it's Michelle Caggiano, one of my former students at the Appalachian School of Law, making her sixth appearance on the show?
Number six.
Mm-hmm. Tremendous. One of the particular reason, among all the other strong reasons we love having you on the show, Michelle, is because since this is such a local case and since it does have a strong local history, could you tell us, first of all, are you from this region originally?
I'm actually from Johnson City and Jonesboro area combined, so
okay.
Yep, I grew up here.
You grew up here, so you're legitimate then. Well, do you remember anything about this case out of Hawkins County back in the late 1980s?
Well, in 83, when this actually started, I would have been, at the risk of telling the nation my age, a preteen.
Okay. So, and you weren't paying a lot of attention to constitutional cases as a preteen?
No, not too much then, but it was on the news.
Okay. So, do you remember anything about it at all?
I remember a little as far as it being, a big deal and kind of dividing the community a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And of course, involving, from a constitutional perspective, what we often call freedom of religion.
Yes, a very touchy subject here.
Very touchy subject here. Well, since you don't remember much about the case, the Hawkins County case, which incidentally the official name is the Mozert case, M-O-Z-E-R-T, since you don't remember much about Mozert, could you tell us just a little bit about East Tennessee, and specifically about the churches here and people's religious beliefs?
Well, East Tennessee is part of the Bible Belt. Mm-hmm. So we actually have a lot of churches here, a lot of different denominations. We have, Baptists, Free Will Baptists, Catholics, Protestants, and mm-hmm. as in general. So, Presbyterians.
Yeah. In fact, Protestantism sort of naturally lends itself to that sort of splintering, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
And it really has occurred in this part of the country.
It does, yes.
Yeah, in fact, just about every church corner, every street corner you look on, you're going to see a different church.
Right.
And do those churches all get along in your experience?
No, not really.
Okay.
In general, they try to teach tolerance of other religions, but mm-hmm. I've been to several different churches myself, mm-hmm. and they don't seem very tolerant of other types of religions. With some of the Baptists, you have Free Will Baptist and Baptist, and there's a big difference on, style and beliefs. And there's some that, look at Catholic churches as not being part of Christianity in itself. So.
Wow. And then, of course, those Mormons. They're a special subject all to themselves, right?
They are.
Yeah, it's a subject Mitt Romney knows all about these days. Okay, well, then you've got, it's not monolithic then, is what we're saying. This is certainly overwhelmingly a Christian area, if you ask people, and probably most people would agree they're conservative Christians. Mm-hmm. But that masks a much greater complexity here.
Right.
In this area. It's a real tapestry of mostly Protestant denominations. And that's sort of the background to this case, because as we shall see, the Mozert case actually began as a conflict between two groups, both of which identified themselves as conservative Christians.
Yes.
And of course, since one of those groups was a governmental group, well, now we have a constitutional issue.
Right, and we're dealing with the degrees of the beliefs.
All right. Well, later on we'll have Michelle back and we'll talk a bit more about the constitutional landscape. In the meantime, I have the enormous pleasure of introducing a fellow by the name of Stephen Bates. Now, Stephen Bates is currently a professor out at the Hank Greenspun School of Journalism and Media Studies out in at UNLV, University of Nevada at Las Vegas. But his background is actually law. He's a graduate of the Harvard Law School, I think a magna cum laude graduate of Harvard Law School. And shortly after graduating from Harvard Law School back in the 1980s, Stephen Bates wrote a book called Battleground. Battleground, which discusses this very case out of Hawkins County, Tennessee. And I had the great pleasure of interviewing him recently, and he is going to tell us this whole story, and I'm going to talk with him a bit about the constitutional issues.
What happened was that in the fall of 1983 in Hawkins County, Tennessee, a housewife named Vicki Frost, who was 31 years old at the time, looked at her sixth grade daughter's reading book and saw some things that disturbed her religious beliefs. Now, Vicki Frost at this point described herself to me as a homebody homemaker. She was not an activist. She'd never been to public meetings. She'd never written letters to politicians. She'd never ridden on an airplane at this point in her life. She was and is a fundamentalist Christian, a conservative Christian, who says that Christianity controls every aspect of her life. And she did everything she could to insulate her family from things that she considered ungodly, so that she told them, for example, that Santa Claus doesn't exist because Christmas should be about Jesus. She kept them from listening to rock music. She vetted the television and movies they watched. She witnessed to me very frequently when I was working on this book. I don't share her religious beliefs, but she kept trying. She had a friend named Jenny Wilson, who was older, somewhat better educated, and a little more worldly. And together, the two of them had been listening to radio preachers talking about sort of the political offshoots of conservative Christianity, in particular a concept called secular humanism.
Mm-hmm.
Vicki Frost's sixth-grade daughter came to her with a question from this reading book about a story involving telepathy, and Vicki Frost and Jenny Wilson believed from these radio preachers they'd been listening to that telepathy is an element or a sign of the Antichrist. So they thought this new reading book published by Holt Reinhardt and Winston was teaching about the Antichrist, was teaching things completely antithetical to their religious beliefs.
This was a reading book. So this was a book that just had excerpts or short stories that were supposed to help elementary school children learn how to read?
Yes, exactly. And as it turned out, they were chosen with great care not to offend people, really. It's funny, trade publishers like Simon & Schuster that published my book tend to think any publicity is good publicity as far as selling books. School book publishers that deal with public schools, elementary schools, and high schools seem to think that any publicity is bad publicity, is bad news. They don't want any sort of fuss. And therefore, they tried very hard to select things that wouldn't cause any controversy. They didn't do quite good enough a job.
And apparently
that
not.
May have, the school book series published by Holt went out of print not long thereafter, and the senior editor told me he thought the Hawkins County case contributed to that.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, so it did certainly had some effect there.
Yes, it did. It did seem to. So they started with this one story of that involved telepathy, went to the school board, initially to the school superintendent, and complained about that. But then, and he said maybe we could take a pair of scissors and cut that story out. He didn't seem to take them very seriously. They thought he was kind of facetious. Jenny Wilson and Vicki Frost, started looking through more of these school books through other grades in the whole Reinhardt Winston series, and they found more things that were against their religious beliefs. Now, these weren't things that were saying the Bible is false or Christianity is false or anything like that. They were things that these people interpreted as being against their religious beliefs in a more complicated way, as being elements of secular humanism or the Book of Revelation or something. So that, for example, magic, talk of the theory of evolution, even gun control, feminism, all these things they said offended their religious beliefs. There seemed they talked of religion and Christianity as dominating their lives, and at times it seemed as though religion and politics were the same.
But those attitudes are very common in this part of the country, and yet you say that her complaints were not received sympathetically by the school board or the authorities?
People down there told me that in Hawkins County, which is a small rural county, pretty much everybody shares conservative Christian religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
I was told I would have an awfully hard time finding an atheist in Hawkins County.
But, I think they were probably right.
Right.
Or at least anyone who would admit to it.
Exactly. But the school board members to whom Vicki Frost and Jenny Wilson and others ended up taking their complaints were not immersed in this talk of secular humanism, in these matters having to do with what Vicki Frost had learned from these radio preachers and her friend Jenny Wilson had learned from books published by them. So the school board members were presented with these complaints that didn't make a whole lot of sense to them. Had it been something that was a flat contradiction of the first commandment or something like that, the school board members would have said, I believe, sure, that doesn't belong in our schools. But it was this more complicated offshoot to do with secular humanism, and the board members just were not immersed in that literature. And to people who are not immersed, as I wasn't to start with, these complaints don't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she didn't get a sympathetic hearing. In fact, she felt like they were sort of laughing at her. So
right. Initially, they held a meeting and got more than 100 people who were concerned parents and told them that there were fundamental problems with these books. Around that time, Vicki Frost was in touch with a couple in Texas named Mel and Norma Gabler.
Ah, yeah.
Who reviewed at that point school books reviewed school books, and then their reviews were widely used by parents, school boards, and even textbook publishers. They were a very conservative Christian couple with no particular expertise. They were not highly educated, but they were incredibly influential, especially in Texas, where school books were adopted statewide. There was essentially one portal to the entire state of Texas, and the Gablers were standing there with their criticisms.
And that's extremely important. If I may interrupt, now correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of the textbook market is that it's expensive to put out different issues of different versions of a particular textbook. So textbook publishers are very eager to be adopted in these very populous states like California or Texas, because then they can be adopted throughout the country. But if they're not adopted in Texas or California, then they're going to have difficulty.
That's right. And in order to be adopted in a conservative state, then they must exclude certain things or downplay certain things, the theory of evolution being the most frequently cited one.
Mm-hmm.
And school book publishers don't like to have to create, as you said, a different edition for New York State than for Texas, so that whatever the most conservative state insists upon, especially if it's a large state like Texas, that's what the nation gets.
So the Gablers were extraordinarily influential, not just in their home state, but throughout the nation.
That's right. They were producing this information and providing it to others. I interviewed them, and as with Vicki Frost and her friends, a lot of their complaints didn't make a lot of sense to me. But they did point out, to their credit, they did point out flat errors in school books. Not all of the points they were making were rooted in Christianity. They were discovering mistakes in the books. They were, as you say, highly influential, and they were against the Holt Reinhardt series that was adopted in Hawkins County. So they sent their review of the Holt series to Vicki Frost, and that was the beginning of something that ultimately became quite significant in this story. namely the involvement of outsiders mm-hmm. in Hawkins County. So the Gablers were the first outsiders involved, and they were involved by sending their review of this textbook series to Vicki Frost. At the next thing that happened was that an insurance agent, adjuster named Bob Mosert, got involved with Vicki Frost and Jenny Wilson and some other people who had developed complaints about these books. Bob Mosert had master's degrees and credits toward a doctorate in education. He spoke more smoothly and could approach the school board members perhaps from a more professional perspective than Vicki Frost could. So he became sort of the face of their, they formed an organization to criticize what they saw as shortcomings in the public schools. They went to a school board meeting and asked the board to get rid of the school books. That was the first thing they did. Later, they insisted to me, all of them insisted to me, that they had never asked to ban the school books. And I think these were and are very straightforward, candid, honest people who authentically and honestly misremembered. They had, in going to court, ended up not asking that the books be banned, but that they themselves be given alternative school books. And I think they persuaded themselves that that's what they'd been asking for all along.
So initially they asked for the books to be removed, but then later simply said, we want to be excused, or we want our children to be excused from reading these books.
Exactly.
Okay.
As I said, the board members who were not immersed in secular humanism studies were largely perplexed by these complaints. And this was a new school book series adopted recently by Hawkins County, which was not a wealthy county school system. They couldn't afford to get rid of the whole books anyway, so it was a sort of moot discussion from their perspective. They told Vicki Frost and Bob Mosert that they had followed the proper procedures in adopting the books. They had gone through the committee of school teachers and all, and they were going to continue using them. Some of the school board members, who were a little concerned, took the school books and showed them to their own pastors, who took a look and said that there didn't seem to be anything wrong with these books. Mike Ferris, who ended up later representing Vicki Frost in court, said to me when I interviewed him that he wished that the plaintiffs, like Vicki Frost, had been wearing turbans. That there is more, greater respect from his perspective when a believer's claims differ from your own, that we tend to kind of give the benefit of the doubt to somebody who is a member of a religious faith we don't fully understand.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Hawkins County, it was sort of Christian against Christian, and the pastors of the school board members said, these books look fine to us, and therefore Vicki Frost must be wrong.
Well, that's very interesting, because one of the things that perplexed me about this story was that this is such a heavily conservative Christian area, and this seemed like such an intramural squabble, but that's actually perhaps why it became such a cause celeb, is because the school board members or the members of the community felt themselves free to disagree with Vicki Frost, whereas maybe they wouldn't have felt free to disagree with a Hindu or a Muslim.
I think that's exactly right. There is a tendency for people of a given faith to think that others within that faith who take a dramatically different interpretation or approach or lifestyle are getting it wrong. And when that happens in a legal setting, including in this school board responding to these complaints, that can be very problematic
mm-hmm.
and raises a lot of important issues. The families, Vicki Frost et al., felt that the school board was not being responsive to their complaints, and at this point they organized what they called COBS, which was Citizens Organized for Better Schools, with Bob Mosert as the head of it. And they felt that the school books were terrible, but they thought maybe this was the tip of the iceberg. So they began looking into other problems with the schools from their perspective. And they complained about some racy books that were in the library, that there were, they thought there ought to be a dress code at the schools. They found that one classroom had a 48-star flag instead of a 50-star flag, and they complained about these various things before the school board. They next, having failed to get rid of the Holt books, sought alternatives for their own children. And some schools, some school principals and teachers granted those requests so that the children of the affected parents would read from a different reading book during reading class, either in the classroom or in a different room, and would be assessed based on this different reading book. Now, as I was figuring out the story, it seemed to me that if you pull back the camera at this point, this is partly a success story. The protesters, Cobbs, Frost, and everyone, had exercised their First Amendment right in a perfectly plausible way to say that these Holt books violated the values and mores of Hawkins County.
Mm-hmm.
The community, Hawkins County, in the form of the school board, had responded that, no, you're mistaken. And these were the duly elected representatives of Hawkins County. And so the book stayed. But several of the schools recognized the legitimacy of dissent and provided alternatives to these children who were affected so that you had majority rule and minority rights both respected at this point. So not a bad story. From there, things unraveled, unfortunately. The school board got exasperated by this stream of complaints and by a growing amount of embarrassing publicity in East Tennessee, and they ordered that no alternatives be permitted, that every student in the Hawkins County schools would have to read the Holt series.
So some teachers and some principals were willing to grant these accommodations. They were willing to excuse the children and or give them different readers, and yet the school board said they were no longer going to allow those accommodations to be made?
That's exactly right, and I think the teachers knew what would work. They're in a position, they're closest to the students. They knew what could be pulled off and what could not, better than the school board did. But the school board's attorney later told me when I interviewed him that the school board felt it was time to send a message, namely, we're running this school board, not you, Vicki Frost. So it became an issue of power. Really, it was time, from their perspective, to put down this protest, to show who was in charge.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we've been talking to Professor Stephen Bates of the University of Nevada at Las Vegas about his book Battleground, which describes in great detail the very famous Mozart case, the textbook dispute out of Hawkins County, Tennessee. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue our discussion with Professor Stephen Bates. Stay tuned.
The devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you. The boy said, my name's Johnny.
Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz with our quiz lady from Montpelier, Kelly Carmichael. Are you with us?
Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing so well. I'm just so happy. I could go on at great length, but then I would bore people. So I'll simply say, yes, I'm doing well. And how about you?
Oh, I'm great. Everything at James Madison's Montpelier is just beautiful as always.
As always. Well, we have a contestant with us. She's extremely nervous.
Oh, no.
So we're going to have to be very gentle with her today. Ms. Contestant, will you tell us your name and where you're from?
My name is Susanna Hedlund, and I'm from Asheville, North Carolina.
All right, Susanna, are you going to pass out on us? Or are you going to
Probably.
Be able to do... No, I think you'll do just fine. Thank you for coming in today. Kelly, what do you have for Susanna?
All right, Susanna, here's your question. No need to be scared, but fortunately we're not near each other if you need to throw anything at me. All right, Susanna, here's a question for you. Looking at the Constitution and amendments in the Constitution, since the Constitution was ratified in 1789, more than 10,000 amendments have been introduced in Congress. How many amendments have been formally added to the Constitution? Is it A, 10, B, 27, C, 37, or D, 40?
Can you say the answers one more time?
A, 10 amendments, B, 27 amendments, C, 37 amendments, or D, 40 amendments.
And Susanna is being so good. She actually has in her hand a pocket copy of the Constitution.
Oh, no, you can't. We let another contestant one time do that. And, you know, this she has to know.
But she very, very morally declined to open it. And she is puzzling over these choices. Why don't you talk us through and tell us?
Very good, Susanna.
Well, I'm going to make a guess here.
Actually. You're just going to make it with no explanation at all. Well, talk us through. Tell us why you would choose or not choose A. A is 10.
From what I recall, there are more than that.
There are more than that. Okay. Yes. In fact, we had the Bill of Rights. They were the first 10, and so you think there's something beyond them.
Yes.
All right. So 10 is off.
Okay. My answer choice that I'm going to go with, and I'm probably wrong, is going to be C.
C, 37?
Yes.
Okay, but before we get there, why not B, 27?
I think there are more than that.
You just think there
yes,
are more than
there
that?
Are more than
okay,
that.
And so then D, 40 is close to 37. Why not 40, okay. Right? And why
it's
not
too even of an answer.
Oh, it's too even?
I'm
going to
go with C.
You're going to go with C, and C is your final answer.
C is my final answer.
Kelly?
Susanna, close, but no cigar, my friend. The answer is 27 amendments. And, you know, that's tough because, you know, more than 10,000 amendments have been proposed, and it takes quite a long process for an amendment to actually come into our Constitution. If you actually be amended into the Constitution, ratified into the Constitution, if you actually... you know, think about it. Since 1789, only 27 amendments have been added into our Constitution. It's very impressive.
Susanna, you should not feel the least bit bad about that, because I doubt that most Americans would have any idea how many there are. But it's an important point, because the first 10 amendments were introduced and ratified within just 3 years of the initial 4 years of the initial adoption of the document. And they were all ratified in 1791. So if you think about it, most people consider the Bill of Rights almost part of the original Constitution. So really, since 1791, it's only been amended 17 times. Article 5 of the original Constitution sets out a very difficult and laborious and lengthy ratification process for amendments. And that's an important point to remember. It's hard to amend the Constitution, and that's by design.
So, absolutely. Absolutely. And even if you go back and, you know, now that you were great, Susanna, not opening your Constitution and finding the answer. But if you go and open it now and look at the 27th Amendment, that was actually originally proposed as part of the original 10 Bill of Rights in 1789. Really, didn't get passed or ratified until 1992.
That is such a cool point you make, because you're right. If you look at the Bill of Rights, I think there was something like 16 that were proposed, and only 10 ultimately that were ratified in 1791. But then there are those extra ones that were hanging out around there, and there was no expiration date on them.
Mm-hmm.
So when the final state ratified the 27th Amendment, it was, you know, like 200 years later. And I wonder if there are any others just hanging out there that could still be ratified. I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not sure.
Right, because now there's limits of how long states have to actually ratify an amendment.
And that's actually the reason.
If you pass that time limit, then the amendment has to basically start back at, you know, ground zero.
Right. In fact, when new amendments are proposed, they almost always have time limits included with them. And probably the most famous example of an expiration was the proposed Equal Rights Amendment back in the 1970s. And it looked like it was on its way to being ratified, and it very well might have been if there had been no time limit. But since there was one, it failed ultimately. Okay, well, thank you, Susanna,
very much
for taking our quiz, and thank you, Kelly.
Thank you so much.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're discussing the great Hawkins County textbook debate of the 1980s. It became a national battle with constitutional significance, but it all started with a self-described homebody housewife named Vicki Frost.
Vicki Frost, at this point, was represented not only by a local lawyer, but by Michael Ferris from a Washington organization called Concerned Women for America. So once again, we have outsiders coming in and playing what became, I think, a key role, a decisive role in this controversy.
Now, who were Concerned Women for America? What was their reason for being?
Well, Concerned Women for America was, in some ways, the lower profile female counterpart to the Moral Majority. It was a very conservative organization, a very Christian, deeply Christian organization. Vicki Frost and her friends had been contacting a lot of Christian organizations and had gotten some sign of interest from Concerned Women for America. When Vicki Frost got arrested, that really cemented it for CWA. That made Michael Ferris, their lawyer, think this is a case we need to get involved in. And so they did. They came into it. Vicki Frost ended up suing over the false arrest, which is a whole sort of sub-story that doesn't matter so much as to the merits. What does matter is that using through the lawyer, Michael Ferris, she and the others filed a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit in court at this point, seeking alternative textbooks in the schools. And the case was called Mozart versus Hawkins County Schools, with Bob Mozart as the lead plaintiff. It was assigned to Judge Hall, Judge Thomas Hall in Greenville, who had been newly appointed to the bench. And basically their argument was that the obligation to read these whole books violated their family's free exercise of religion. Under the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause, at that point, religious claimants, religious people, could sometimes get special treatment from the government where something burdened their religion. One especially well-known case involved the Amish claiming that for the requirements of education, higher education through high school, conflicted with their religious beliefs. And the Supreme Court said, you're right, your kids can get out of school earlier, at an earlier age than other kids. And the court made a point of saying, if you were Henry David Thoreau just wanting to live in the woods, you wouldn't get this special treatment. It's because you're Amish, because you're raising a religious objection, that you get this special treatment.
And that's the famous Yoder case.
Exactly. Okay. And that's the argument that Vicki Frost and all were making. The plaintiffs in the case, the people seeking alternative books, had their outside organization based in D.C., Concerned Women for America. The defendants, the school system, ended up getting their own counterpart, their own outside organization, People for the American Way. And the lawyer who worked pro bono for People for the American Way was a fellow named Tim Dyke. Now, Michael Ferris from CWA was and is an impassioned fundamentalist Christian, deeply committed to the cause. Tim Dyke, by contrast, was and is a highly professional lawyer, but dispassionate. For him, this was really just another case. Exemplifying that, before I went to Greenville lately, I emailed both of the lawyers and asked them if they had any reflections 25 years later about the case. And here's a little bit of what Mike Ferris responded. I still have deep and strong views about the positions of each side, but I have nothing but kind thoughts and good memories of all for all the people I got to know in the case. I deeply admire Judge Hall. I still disagree strongly with the positions taken by the school district and their counsel in the case, but I would love to see all of the people again. So that's Mike Ferris. Tim Dyke, I also emailed, his response was, it is not a subject that I've given much thought to in recent years. So he's moved on. He, in fact, is a judge now in D.C. with the Federal Circuit. And really, for him, it was just another case. For Mike Ferris, it was a pivotal case.
A crusade, yeah. Yeah.
His religious beliefs. So I can say a little more about the two organizations, but just the involvement of these organizations heightened the demonization and the conspiratorial thinking.
Sure. Now, Concerned Women of America, we mentioned as being an adjunct to the Moral Majority, which, of course, was Jerry Falwell's group back in the 80s. But People for the American Way, that's the one that's still around, that was organized by Norman Lear, right?
That's right. It was and is a very liberal organization, unlike the people of Hawkins County. It was founded by Norman Lear essentially as a response to the moral majority. It positioned itself as a nonpartisan constitutional liberties foundation. But really what it was an organization created to oppose the Christian right in every manifestation. One woman who had worked for People for the American Way, Barbara Parker, I went to her and asked, what if instead of conservative Christian children in this case, it had been Amish children who had found a school book offensive and had sought alternatives? Would People for the American Way have come in against them? And Barbara Parker said, no, we probably would have been on their side.
Oh, my goodness.
So this isn't wow. not really a nonpartisan constitutional liberties organization, really a political organization that mm-hmm. was using constitutional law to make broader political points.
Oh, perish the thought.
Yeah, exactly, which happens broadly enough. But there are mm-hmm. organizations such as the ACLU that will champion the rights of free speech, say, even if they completely disagree with the speech. People for the American Way, at this point in its evolution, was not one of those mm-hmm. organizations. And the involvement of these two outside organizations, I think, led to this greater demonization, so that the plaintiffs and their organization were saying, we're fighting a secular humanist takeover. And the defendants, the school board and their organization, People for the American Way, were saying, we're fighting a religious right takeover. So it sort of heightened the stakes from the perspective of both sides. And in doing so, naturally enough, it simplified a very complicated reality. As I researched this case and interviewed a lot of the people involved in it, I came to the conclusion that they were mostly perfectly decent people acting in good faith, doing the best they could, confronting an unknown and confusing situation. But they were demonizing each other more and more as time went on.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're talking about the famous Hawkins County textbook battle of the 1980s. There were allegations that the textbooks were full of secular humanism, the devil, and even witchcraft.
Those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft. And I've got no defense for it, the heat is too intense for it. What good would common sense for it do?
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now we're going to continue our discussion with Professor Stephen Bates, author of Battleground.
The law at that time was that if a religious group could show that there was an infringement of their free exercise of religion, the burden in the case shifted to the government to satisfy something called strict scrutiny, which means the government had to show two things, that it had a very compelling interest for what it wanted to do, that is, in that case, to make the Amish children attend till they were 16, and that secondly, that it was the only way to achieve that compelling interest to do what the government wanted to do, to make them attend school. And strict scrutiny is such an enormously difficult test to meet that effectively it meant, under the Yoder Doctrine, that accommodations were going to be granted.
That's right. That's essentially the legal question confronting Judge Thomas Hull in this case.
Well, forgive me for interrupting, but it seems to me cut and dried then. It seems to me that if they had applied that analysis we've just described, the plaintiffs win.
That's the way it looked, certainly, to Michael Ferris. Tim Dyke, the defense attorney, thought there were some complications to it. And essentially, the way it unfolded was, as you suggested, the question confronting Judge Hull is, does mandatory assignment of these Holt books violate the plaintiff's free exercise rights of religion?
And courts are very deferential, at least at that time they were.
It was at that point a four-part test. The first was, is there a sincere religious belief?
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court had said, it doesn't have to be logical, it doesn't have to be comprehensible, it doesn't have to be shared by others of the same faith. It's okay if it was newly adopted. You don't have to have grown up in this particular faith. But, as I said, it has to be religious. Henry David Thoreau doesn't get the Yoder exemption.
Exactly. But it doesn't matter if it's ridiculous in people's minds either. So if these people come in and say, we don't want our kids reading about witchcraft or telepathy because exposure to these ideas is anathema to our religious beliefs, that's really all they have to say. And as long as the judge defers to their statement that they are sincere in this belief, they've met the first part of that test.
Generally, that the courts were very deferential
yeah.
to whatever believers said was a sincere religious belief. And you can see how for a judge to be cross-examining a believer about his or her faith could really intrude on free exercise values.
Yeah.
It's really not the job of government to be quizzing people about their religious faith. The same basic level of deference applied to the second part of the test which was, is the religious belief burdened? Which meant that the government has to, in order to have a free exercise problem, directly be penalizing religious activity or coercing believers into violating their beliefs. The courts pretty frequently took the plaintiff's word that his or her faith was burdened. And there were dangers of a sort of entanglement between church and state under the Establishment Clause, and of the judge imposing his or her own religious beliefs to say there's not a burden. And it's potentially a little offensive, too. In lower courts, when Jehovah's Witnesses in the 1930s were refusing to salute the flag, the Supreme Court ended up taking a different approach. But in a lot of the lower courts, judges said to the Jehovah's Witnesses, you guys claim that the Book of Exodus forbids you to bow down before graven images and the American flag is a graven image, but you're wrong. And we, as judges, understand your faith better than you do. And, you know, that's a little bit offensive.
Yeah.
And that's often what it comes down to in cases where a defendant is, at this point, as the law stood, was disputing the religious burden level.
So for all of those reasons, courts are very deferential. If you come in and say, this is my religious belief, they'll say, okay. And if you say, and what the state is doing, the state school in this case, burdens my religious belief, they'll say, well, okay, well, yeah, I mean, you're the one who knows what your religion is. So the first two parts of this four-part test almost always go to the plaintiff. And it doesn't matter how ridiculous you might think their beliefs are if you're the judge. You typically defer to them. So at that point, the burden shifts to the state to satisfy strict scrutiny, and that's, you know, when I was reading your book, I was thinking, well, you know, they're going to win.
Well, the state had to show it had a compelling interest, and
yeah.
that for Judge Hall and in most of these cases was easy. States can show a compelling interest in almost anything. Then the real test is whether, in pursuing that compelling interest, the government is using the least restrictive means, which in free exercise cases at this point generally meant, what's the harm in excusing these plaintiffs?
Yeah.
So in the Yoder case, the Amish, the question was, what's the harm in excusing these particular Amish kids from education? In a few cases, the Supreme Court would say that it had to look at a harm that might be arising more broadly if everybody claimed this sort of religious conflict. So that there was a case where the Amish said that paying Social Security taxes offended their religious beliefs. And the Supreme Court said, no dice.
That could be a very dangerous argument if the court were to accept that.
Well, exactly. The court, in looking at a case like that, basically said, we're not thinking just about you, Amish plaintiffs. We're thinking about everybody who might have some religious objection to what the government does with its money.
You know, Stephen, come to think of it, I think it violates my religious beliefs to pay any taxes at all. So,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck.
Good luck. But going back to the Mozart case, I mean, again, I was really surprised that they didn't simply apply the straightforward test and come to the conclusion that I've said that the plaintiffs should get some sort of accommodation here. But they didn't. I mean, they mixed in the Establishment Clause. They
it went through some sort of convoluted twists along the way. The first thing was that in 1984, Judge Hall just dismissed the case and said there is no burden on your religious beliefs because these school books are not teaching you to believe anything. And he said the First Amendment doesn't protect you from mere exposure to ideas that you find contrary or even offensive to your religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
The First Amendment, according to Judge Hall in 1984, would protect you from a book that actually taught an ultimate religious truth, such as that one religion was actually superior to others, or that all religions were equal regarding salvation, that none of them was superior to others. But the books, he said, weren't teaching anything like that. They were perfectly religiously neutral from his perspective. And the plaintiffs appealed. They thought that they had a stronger case. It went up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and in 1985, the Sixth Circuit said, no, Judge Hull, you have to hold a trial. There are some disputed issues of fact here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Judge Hull later said that he had essentially been applying a kind of Establishment Clause test at this point. He hadn't really understood the nuances of the Free Exercise Clause, that he had been asking essentially whether these books violated separation of church and state, and that wasn't the question.
No, it wasn't, but I'm going to say a word on behalf of Judge Hall. I've never met the man, but first of all, I think you said in the book this was the very first case assigned to him once he became a federal judge?
It was, yes, very early in his tenure.
And then I'll further say, and you can confirm this if you wish, that Establishment Clause and Free Exercise Law are two of the most messed up areas of constitutional law that exist.
They are very messy. They are contradictory, and even more so at this point, the way the law was. And expanding either one of them to an extreme was going to infringe on the values of the other one.
Okay, yeah. So when I say that I thought that I saw the answer to this and I thought it was fairly clear, I certainly don't mean to criticize Judge Hull. This is a tough area of law. And so that's what happened. So there was a bit of confusion. It went up to the Sixth Circuit. They sent it back, and they said, have a trial. And so that's when the drama really began, wasn't it?
That's right. Then in 1986, Judge Hall had a trial by agreement of both sides. There was no jury. And symbolically, really, reporters sat in the jury box. That was the real jury, was journalists. Almost all of them were hostile to the plaintiffs. And they were often hostile in their coverage to East Tennessee generally. They talked about this as Scopes 2, for instance, likening it to the case about the teaching of evolution. And they essentially, the press made Hawkins County a national laughingstock. I parenthetically, I should say, I was really grateful that people there would talk to me as an outsider after everything they'd been through,
mm-hmm.
after the mocking that they'd been through at the hands of outsiders. People for the American Way had been created by Norman Lear, essentially initially in particular, to publicize its views and to publicize antagonism toward or to show the flaws, the shortcomings of the religious right, the moral majority in particular. It began as a public relations organization, and it was brilliant in framing the issues. Scopes 2 was the way it framed the issues, which implied that the plaintiffs were trying to ban these books, not just get alternatives. And they were dealing with very fertile ground on the part of journalists from outside that region. A lot of journalists, like, as we talked about, a lot of Americans in general, were already hostile to fundamentalist Christians, or at the very least uncomprehending. The Washington Post in 1993 said of the people who were followers of Jerry Falwell and of Pat Robertson that they were, quote, largely poor, uneducated, and easy to command.
Hmm.
This was in a news
mm-hmm.
story. And the Post later apologized. But, 1993, that was the way a lot of journalists saw the Christian right. And that was true in 86 when this case was going through Judge Hull's courtroom. But I have to say the Hawkins County plaintiffs, Vicki Frost and her friends, sometimes made it easy to mock them and to deride their positions, their viewpoints. They had made some early objections to fairy tales in the kindergarten and the first grade books. They did not file suit over those, but because they had initially objected to these fairy tales, that was constantly brought back to show what ridiculous people they were.
Yeah, in fact, didn't a lot of people say they characterized Vicki Frost and the rest of them as wanting to ban The Wizard of Oz and even, I think, The Diary of Anne Frank?
Well, that really poisoned the well against them. They objected to one passage in a play based on The Diary of Anne Frank, in which the character Anne Frank says basically that all religions are equal.
Mm-hmm.
They had a comprehensible, at least, objection that, in their view, all religions are not equal. Christianity is superior, and they didn't want their children taught to the contrary. But for People for the American Way, this was a home run. You know, anybody who objects to Diary of Anne Frank is obviously anti-Semitic. Concerned Women for America, which was representing the plaintiffs in this case, actually had to put out a news release saying CWA and the parents do not dislike Jewish people. I think when you have to put out a news release with that phrase in it, you've lost the PR war.
I am not an anti-Semite is about as effective as I am not a crook.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It just shows the magnitude of the victory of People for the American Way in framing these issues for the
press. What actually happened in the courtroom, though? How did Judge Hull rule at the end of this trial?
He confronted, as we talked about, this four-part test. The first was, is there a sincere religious belief? The two sides had stipulated that. The defendants, Tim Dyke, said it has to be a central religious belief, and this doesn't qualify. Judge Hull said no, it doesn't have to be central. And later, the Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court said a religious belief is all it takes. It doesn't have to be central to your theology. Then the issue was, are these people burdened? They said that the readings might undercut their religious beliefs. And in Judge Hull's words, the plaintiff's religious beliefs compel them to refrain from exposure to the whole series. Refrain from exposure really is key as this case unfolds on appeal. So then the third issue is there a compelling state interest? Judge Hull told me that was an easy one. Education, it's a cinch. There's a compelling state interest.
Sure, yeah.
And then, is this the least restrictive means? The defendants had raised three major issues. First of all, they had said the plaintiff's objections really apply across the curriculum. And for them to feel that they are in a religiously hospitable environment, they're going to have to use private school or homeschooling. That's the only way. Judge Hull rejected that argument and said, I have to look at what they're filing suit over, not at all future possibilities. It's not my job to extrapolate their religious beliefs to the rest of the curriculum. Second, the defendant said that the accommodation the plaintiffs want, a different series of reading books just for their own kids, which is what some, as we talked about, some schools had been providing, would be unworkable, that kids would be coming and going from the classrooms, teachers wouldn't know what to discuss, that it just couldn't work in a public schoolroom. Judge Hull rejected that. He said that you defendants didn't introduce any evidence that the alternatives in practice had produced any problems for the public schools. And then the third argument the defendants raised was that if you allow this accommodation, there's going to be a flood of people wanting to opt out of different parts of the curriculum, the slippery slope argument.
Mm-hmm.
And Judge Hull responded to that it's never arisen before. Hawkins County people, as we talked about, are basically of the same religious beliefs, and there was no reason to think that there was going to be a mass attempt to get out of parts of the curriculum as a result of this. So Judge Hull concluded, mandatory assignment of the whole books was not the least restrictive means, and the parents were entitled to relief. But, he said, They're not entitled to the relief they want. They wanted the schools, as the schools had been doing, to continue providing alternative textbooks for their children and to use the parts of those alternative textbooks that the parents approved of. The parents had said, we don't have any set of alternatives that we like all the way through. For even sets of books that we like a lot better than the whole books, there's some things we don't want you teaching our kids. Judge Hull said, you can't expect school teachers to be making judgments based on the parents' religion, and that it could, in fact, violate the Establishment Clause to do so, to create this entanglement between church and state. So instead, Judge Hull said, here's my compromise. The children should be excused from reading, period, altogether, and the parents should teach reading at home. Judge Hull said, Tennessee allows homeschooling. Why can't it allow partial homeschooling? So you go to school for everything except reading, and you learn that on your own at home from your parents, and the school district can use standardized tests to measure whether that's working out.
So Judge Hull not only applied the four-part test that existed at that time, but then he came up with a fairly practical solution that balanced the interest of both parties. And I think you approved of that decision, don't you?
I thought that it was a compromise that made sense. Judge Hull, when I interviewed him, said it didn't have a lot to do with constitutional law, that it was kind of a pragmatic middle approach from his perspective, and it seemed like a reasonable approach to me. But the defendants had been right in some respects. Vicki Frost, by that point, had decided that no matter what, she wasn't going to put her kids back in the public schools, that any sort of alternatives and that the rest of the curriculum would represent a compromise for her. It would be compromising her religious beliefs. And she said that's not what God would want for her and her family. So the defense lawyers were right. The plaintiffs really had developed religious objections to the rest of the curriculum.
In fact, right after, to talk about the slippery slope argument the defendants raised, right after their courtroom victory, didn't Ferris come out and stay on the courthouse steps? Next comes biology. Next comes science class. We're going to go and opt out of all parts of the curriculum.
That's right, and that goes to an issue raised by the fact that there were these outside Washington-based organizations. Each of them had an incentive based on publicity and fundraising and other things to magnify the meaning of the court case to the maximum extent possible.
And that's how the famous trial of the Mozart case ended. The plaintiffs won. Judge Hull came to his Solomonic conclusion. There was a reasonable accommodation of their religious beliefs. But that was not the end. Of course, the defendants appealed the case. They went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, and there the three-judge panel found that the plaintiffs lost. They held that there was no religious burden imposed by the school board, simply exposing the children in the case to others' ideas that might be inconsistent with their religious beliefs. Now, the judges had to distinguish that famous Amish case, the Yoder case, where the Supreme Court had pretty much held that mere exposure to ideas could, in fact, violate someone's religious freedom. But they said, no, the Amish case was special. These plaintiffs aren't like the Amish. Therefore, there is no burden on their religious beliefs, and therefore, there is no free exercise violation by the Constitution. Of course, there was a further appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court refused to hear the case, and so that's how matters ended. Vicki Frost and the other plaintiffs lost their case. And that's about as much time as we have today. I'd like to thank Stephen Bates, the author of the book Battleground, for coming on the show and sharing his fascinating account with us. I also thank my former student, Michelle Caggiano, for helping me introduce this topic. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.